the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Billahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says a key principle in any future negotiations is for all parties to return to their commitments under the nuclear deal. China's president says global cooperation is needed to avoid a return to Cold War tensions in the Asia-Pacific. Also coming up, Germany for the first time exceeds 50,000 daily COVID cases as Europe is witnessing a sharp surge in the pandemic. World News, we're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran says the return of all parties to the 2015 nuclear deal to their commitments is an important and leading principle in future negotiations. Iran's Foreign Minister, Amir Hossein Amir Abdullahian, also says Tehran is ready to deliver a good agreement at the negotiating table in Vienna. That's where Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear accord have held several rounds of talks this year to revive the troubled deal. They are set to resume negotiations aimed at removing U.S. sanctions on November 29th. Amir Abdullahian says Iran's chief negotiator, Ali Bagheri Kani, is currently engaged in what he calls successful talks in Europe. Bagheri Kani is on a tour to France, Germany, and Britain. No end in sight to Saudi Arabia's military aggression against neighboring Yemen. Yemeni media say Saudi warplanes attacked locations across Sana'a, Sada, and Amran provinces just hours ago. No casualties have been reported yet. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. Since then, hundreds of thousands of people have lost their lives and many more have been displaced. The years-long aggression has also targeted the country's infrastructure, leaving the Yemeni people in abject misery. The United Nations has called the situation in Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. There has been mounting concern about the lives of six hunger-striking Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails as two of them suffer from serious health conditions. According to the relatives of Al-Araj, he is at high risk of losing his eyesight due to weeks of starvation. Another prisoner, Miqdad al-Qawasmi, is also in hospital after his health condition worsened. Both inmates have been on hunger strike for 95 and 112 days, respectively. Meanwhile, al-Qawasmi's mother says her son is protesting peacefully against his unlawful detention. but the Israeli regime wants to kill him and other hunger-striking prisoners in any way. All the six prisoners are protesting against Israel's so-called administrative detention policy and want an end to their indefinite imprisonment without charge or trial. Human rights and international organizations have warned that the health conditions of the six prisoners are worsening rapidly. An official delegation from the UAE has visited the Syrian capital, Damascus, for the first time since the beginning of the Syrian crisis. Observers view the visit as a new step in line with the shift of the UAE's policy towards the Arab country. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali is in Damascus.
In an unusual scene, an official Emirati delegation headed by Foreign Minister Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. The two sides discussed bilateral relations and cooperation, especially enhancing investment partnerships in various sectors. Assad underlined the importance of the years-long close ties between both countries. He described the Emirati stances as correct and objective, stressing that the UAE always stood beside Syrians. Analysts say such comments are a clear welcome message for fully restoring relations with the UAE.
President Assad's strategy is based on the interests of the Syrian people and stability in the region as a whole. President Assad previously underlined the importance of security, investment, and development of relations with countries on the basis of non-intervention in each other's internal affairs.
Foreign Minister Abdullah Al Nahyan expressed his country's support for Syria's stability, asserting that events in Syria affected all Arab countries. He reiterated the UAE's readiness to assist the Syrian people. Experts say the visit is a brave step by the UAE and part of the Arab return to Syria.
I believe it is the Arab League that is returning to Syria, not the opposite. Syria has never left the League. There was a conspiracy at the time. Recently, we have seen initiatives by the Arab countries to restore ties with Syria. I believe this visit is a brave step by the UAE in light of the sanctions on Syria.
The UAE was the first Arab country to re-establish diplomatic cooperation with Syria when it reopened its embassy back in 2018. It is the fourth country to send officials to Damascus during the crisis after Oman, Jordan, and Lebanon, reflecting an Arab shift of attitude towards the Syrian government despite U.S. and Western objection. Analysts believe this visit happened only following consultations between the UAE and Saudi Arabia, which has significant influence on Arab countries, and that the UAE is taking the lead as a mediator to bring back Syria to the Arab world, mainly from an economic gateway. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
China is warning against the renewal of Cold War divisions and confrontations in the Asia-Pacific amid continued regional tensions over the issue of Taiwan. The fresh warning from President Xi Jinping comes just days before his planned virtual meeting with U.S. President Joe Biden. Taipei has been a major sticking point between the two sides. Earlier, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken reiterated Washington's military support for Taiwan right after a U.S. delegation's visit to the island angered China. Beijing says Washington should stop all forms of official interaction with Taipei. The Chinese embassy in the U.S. has urged Washington to cooperate to bring the two countries' relations back on track, saying both sides gain from cooperation and lose from confrontation. The European Union's foreign policy chief has warned that Europe is in danger amid fears that the continent's military capabilities are not enough to counter threats. Josep Borrell says threats against Europe are intensifying and the capacity of individual member states to cope with them is insufficient and declining. Borrell believes EU countries need to have rapid deployment capabilities. According to the top EU diplomat, one idea is to have a 5,000-strong crisis force to be able to deal with those threats. Borrell's comments come ahead of a summit of EU foreign and defense ministers to discuss the issue. We've asked former lecturer at Westchester University, Lawrence Davison, to give us his analysis of Borrell's call for a ramped-up defense power. He believes that Europe is actually seeking to reduce its dependence on the U.S. for military support.
I think you can see it as another crack in the hegemonic reliance on the United States. The though the United States, you know, I mean, it did intervene in the Balkans, for instance. It's hard to see, you know, the United States and EU countries directly. I think you're probably right. I mean, this is just, in part anyway, an effort to increase self-reliance and a recognition that whether Biden gives his okay to this, I assume he has, or not, they can't rely on the United States in terms of future administrations, because one of the things that Trump proved is that there's a question mark as to the reliability of the American citizen to recognize any reliable affiliation with Europe.
Let's return to our earlier story regarding China, which has warned against the renewal of Cold War divisions and confrontations in the Asia-Pacific amid continued regional tensions over the issue of Taiwan. The fresh warning came from the Chinese president just days ahead of his planned virtual meeting with the U.S. president, and it just comes days earlier when the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken reiterated Washington's military support for Taiwan. And with us, joining us, is Andrew K.P. Leong. He's an international and independent China strategist. Andrew, welcome. When it comes to provocations, in your opinion, it does seem to be coming from one direction, from Washington, and not just limited to Taiwan. For example, you've got the South China Sea. We hear reports about Hong Kong, about Xinjiang, about Tibet. Are these justified?
It's not just about ideology or human rights, but it's also about technology, about this kind of trade, and about power. In fact, it's a part of a struggle to maintain the so-called American dominance in the world, in a so-called American-led liberal order. There's still a body of thought in the United States clinging to the fading concept of American hegemony or American unipolarity, where American could just call the shots. Obviously, the capacity of the United States to maintain this kind of dominance is much more emaciated in recent years. But still, a lot of the people in the United States, not only in the military, but in the elite, and even a lot of American especially those who are less educated, even including those who are educated, refuse to accept a rising power that could almost equal America in terms of global influence. And President Xi, during this week, is trying to elucidate the rise of the Chinese Communist Party during the past so many years. And in fact, that China is now entering into an era where China, in the search of its China dream, would be increasingly heading towards a kind of conflict and confrontation with the United States, in the sense that the what is called the Citizen's Trap, where the existing superpower refuses to accept a rising challenger, and in 12 out of 16 cases in the past, this has resulted in war. That's why President Xi is calling for calm and looking at the situation more objectively. Obviously, there are differences in the politics and different development model. China's model is based on state-led capitalism, whereas the United States is based on market-led kind of hands-off capitalism. But of course, that the American emphasis on what is perceived to be individual freedom and human rights is not exactly the same, interpreted in the same way in China. But nevertheless,
right, on that point, Andrew, when it comes to, you say, the U.S. raising and human rights, if we take Xinjiang, for example, Washington's always expressed concern about Xinjiang, and America appears only concerned with Muslims in China's Xinjiang province. When it comes to, for example, Muslims in occupied Palestine, in Yemen, in Bahrain, in Saudi Arabia, in Kashmir, nothing. Just Xinjiang. What do you make of that?
Well, of course, the United States is targeting China, not Saudi Arabia or other places, because the other places are not challenging Americans' hegemony. As far as Xinjiang is concerned, if you look at the China's history, if you look at even the renminbi, China's currency, the Xinjiang kind of language is printed on the renminbi looks, suggesting that, of course, the Xinjiang culture and heritage is also respected. But on the other hand, Xinjiang is a hotbed for separatism. And that's why China needs to clamp down on that. It's the same way the kind of concern about national security in other countries. But I think that that's also translated in Hong Kong, where I am. And of course, during the past couple of years, there's been a lot of violent, infested protests, aided and supported by foreign forces. And in the eyes of Beijing, is trying to destabilize Hong Kong with the idea of stabilizing China. So I think that what I'm trying to say is that in this new era, where the two superpowers are getting closer in terms of world influence, there's bound to be a degree of conflict and misunderstanding.
Right.
There is the American cycle ranges from demonization of China, denial of China's rise through military means, through technology, through trade, and various other means. And of course, stressing also competition. But what is failing is acceptance of a different country with a different culture, different model, which can equally legitimate in the eyes of their people, and to be able to live in peace and in harmony. And okay, still, the degree of
Andrew,
acceptance is very, very, very limited.
We have run out of time. Andrew, thank you.
Thank
I'd
you.
Like to thank you for your remarks and your time. Andrew K.P. Leong, there is an international independent China strategist, joining us live out of Hong Kong. Now, Germany has registered its highest number of coronavirus cases since the start of the pandemic, with more than 50,000 new infections in just 24 hours. Health authorities reported 235 deaths in the same period. The figure brings Germany's overall death toll to more than 97,000, where the total caseload stands close to the grim milestone of 5 million. Experts have warned that if the aggressive fourth wave of the virus is not contained, Germany could suffer from 100,000 more COVID-related fatalities. During the past few days, coronavirus infections and deaths skyrocketed in Germany. Officials say the surge could overwhelm the hospitals and even force postponements of operations. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought this sight-giving day through his mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
A Pentagon report treats the killing of an Afghan family as an innocent mistake and upholds the U.S. tradition of excusing war crimes. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jeremy Scahill, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. Absolves Drone Killers and Persecutes Whistleblowers. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. After the terrorist attack on the airport in Kabul, Afghanistan's capital, that killed more than 170 Afghan civilians and 13 U.S. troops, President Joe Biden issued a warning to fighters from Daesh. "We will hunt you down and make you pay," he said on August 26th. 3 days later, Biden authorized a drone strike that the U.S. claimed took out a dangerous cell of ISIS intent on staging another attack on the Kabul airport. Biden held up this strike and another one a day earlier as evidence of his commitment to take the fight to the terrorists in Afghanistan, even as he declared an end to the 20-year war there. "We struck ISIS-K remotely days after they murdered 13 of our service members and dozens of innocent Afghans," he said in a White House speech, adding, "And to ISIS-K, we are not done with you yet." But the Kabul strike, which targeted a white Toyota Corolla, did not kill any members of Daesh. The victims were 10 civilians, 7 of them children. The driver of the car, Zimari Ahmadi, was a respected employee of a U.S. aid organization. Following a New York Times investigation that fully exposed the lie of the U.S. version of events, the Pentagon and the White House admitted that they had killed innocent civilians, calling it a horrible tragedy of war. Recently, the Pentagon released a summary of its classified review into the attack, which it originally hailed as a righteous strike that had thwarted an imminent terror plot. The results were predictable. The report recommended that no personnel be held responsible for the murder of 10 civilians. There is no criminal negligence, as the report put it. The fact that the U.S. military spent 8 hours surveilling the targets, that a child could be seen in its own footage minutes before the strike, this was written off as a fog of war moment. The operators conducting the strike had a genuine belief that there was an imminent threat to the U.S. forces, asserted the Air Force's Inspector General Lieutenant Sami D. said. They committed a mistake, he said, not a crime. The U.S. has promised to pay restitution to the survivors of the drone strike. This is part of a long-standing U.S. tradition to treat its widespread killings of civilians in the so-called War on Terror as innocent mistakes made in pursuit of peace and security. The general who conducted the review days after says he has made recommendations on how to tinker with targeted killing operations to reduce the likelihood of other honest mistakes, as the Pentagon regards them, that wipe out entire families. None of this is new. It is a cycle that got into high gear under President Barack Obama, when Biden vice president, continued during the Donald Trump presidency and is not relenting in the Biden era. As the Pentagon absolves itself of this crime, the Biden administration is pushing ahead with its persecution of whistleblowers who exposed this system of killing innocents. Daniel Hale, a military veteran who pleaded guilty to disclosing classified documents that exposed lethal weaknesses in the drone program, is serving 4 years in prison. Prosecutors said those documents formed the basis for the drone papers, a series of investigative articles published by The Intercept. Among other revelations, Hale's documents exposed how as many as 9 out of 10 victims of U.S. drone strikes in Afghanistan were not intended targets. In Biden's recent drone strike, 10 of 10 were innocent civilians. While Hale was indicted under the Espionage Act during Trump's tenure, Biden's Justice Department has gone after him with a vengeance. In October, Hale was inexplicably transferred to a communications management unit at the U.S. Penitentiary at Marion in southern Illinois. CMUs are used to severely limit a prisoner's ability to communicate with the outside world, subject them to extreme periods of isolation, and allow for intensified surveillance of their communications and visits. CMUs are regularly labeled as terrorist units. And as the Pentagon's mountain of lies about the August drone strike in Afghanistan came tumbling down, the Biden administration continued its quest to extradite WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, being held in the UK for the offense of publishing evidence of U.S. war crimes. The Biden administration has made clear that it will uphold the long U.S. tradition of exonerating its killers and punishing those who expose them.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
A song that has the fragrance of the companion shall take a nation to the companion. Sometimes childhood memories appear before my eyes like a pale pall of imagination. Among those rippling images there sails the craft of my thought towards the shore of silence to anchor in the harbor of its own. I dwell on my existence. Want to decipher the oriental thoughts and secrets and to put an end to my bewilderment and self-alienation. I am a traveler standing on the shore of thoughts. My aim to pinpoint my lost identity.
The Eastern wisdom and Iqbal Lahori. Part 2.
I am a traveler, walking on the road of human thoughts. My destination is the land of belief in oneself, in a bid to revive an identity which might no longer exist. It is an identity which, like a child's toy, is played with, but in a deadly way.
ये वो घर है जहाँ अल्लामा इकबाल 9 November 1877 को सुबह पार.
Here is the very room wherein Iqbal was born on the 9th of November 1877 at 5:14 a.m.
इस घर की इब्तिदा की.
The house here was built by his grandfather, Sheikh Muhammad Rafiq. He was the first to occupy the house. On the 6th of February 1861, he bought 3 small rooms and a house near here until Iqbal was born. Later, Iqbal's elder brother came here. The house has undergone no change since then.
और जो मौजूदा हालत है वो 1912 की है.
Then Muhammad Iqbal went to Punjab University, one of Pakistan's oldest universities, established in 1882 by the British ruler of the Indian subcontinent in Lahore. There the instruction language was English, though some lessons were taught in Urdu.
Allama's poetry consists of certain periods. His poetry was at first as the poetry of the day. He would say at that time, "My Urdu poems are like a building made of clay." Little by little, these Persian poems came into existence. Among the first Persian poems were the familiar secrets and the mysteries of rapture. Such poems end with Javed Name, or perhaps with "What can be done, O Eastern people?"
Gradually, Iqbal changes from a national poet to the poet of the Islamic world. His versified story, "The Familiar Secrets and the Mysteries of Rapture," is first translated into English by Reynold Nicholson and published in the region. Years later, his Javedname is translated into German and Turkish in 1957 by those who study Islam, including Anna Marie Schimmel. The book is published in Munich, Hermann Hesse. The German writer and a winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature writes an introduction to Javedname, as requested by the translator. Hesse writes, "Sir Muhammad Iqbal belongs to three intellectual domains. His works are the outcome of these three intellectual domains: Indian intellectual domain, spiritual domain, and Western thoughts domain."
There are three groups of Persian poets. The first, those who are absolutely meaning-oriented.
Iqbal, as a poet, is highly accomplished. He has bridged the gap between wisdom and heart.
The second, those who are pedantic. Meaning is absent in their poems. They pay attention to words and nothing more.
His poems touch the reader's sensations because they are so meaningful and precede even the thoughts forming in their minds.
The third, those whose poems are full of both words and meanings. From among them, we can name Hafez and Sa'di.
Such senses calm mind, imagination, and consequently heart. This is a rare attribute seen in such great poets as Hafez and Rumi. The attribute is common in all Iqbal's poems.
Allama Iqbal has mastery not only over words, but also over various meanings. Meanings which come out of him and are derived from his thoughts. His meaning-oriented poems outnumber his other types of poems, just as Rumi's. Iqbal says, "There is no comparison between the melody and me. Speaking is only a pretext. I am pulling the camel, which has no rein."
Allama Iqbal, with a faith in Islam and a reasonable Gnostic faith indicating his deep certitude in God's sovereignty, moves his mind to search for secrets and mysteries of the creation. In his Islamic Gnostic poems, and such verified stories as The Souvenir of Hijaz, The Eastern Message, The Familiar Secrets, and The Mysteries of Rapture, he talks about the principles of internal ontology of things, an idealization of the existential world. While his thoughts are at the height of their powers, he invites Muslims to solidify familiar philosophy exactly in accordance to monotheism, to bring about a new perspective, a new world view into the Islamic world.
So many memories are related to this house. My father came to live in this house when he was 11. Now, what sort of memory do you want me to tell you?
Talking about Iqbal's thoughts reminds us of the familiar thoughts as his central train of thought. We hear Iqbal saying, "To a mullah, a denier of God is an unbeliever. To me, more unbeliever is he who denies his own self."
Just ask, what is Iqbal's philosophy? The answer is, the philosophy of your own. Iqbal's philosophy is in fact the philosophy of one's own, or familiar philosophy. What is familiar philosophy? That you know your origin very well.
Never in my life have I been interested in the world's wealth or posts. I built this very house just to accept my wife's repeated requests. My wife's fate in this house had a different form. Here became a safe place for those in search of their identity. I clearly saw that most Muslims in the motherland had lost their Islamic identity, and to regain it, they need to struggle hard. This house, this quiet corner, became a place for those who wish to fly faults of self-belief, something much needed by all.
This house originally belonged to my father, Javed Iqbal. The house title deed had already been issued to my grandmother. Upon the death of my grandmother, the deed was transferred to my father. Allama Iqbal would live here as my father's tenant. He paid the rent to my father every month or every 3 months.
Never did I lose my interest in my native land's people. My best time was when I was among people to see them struggle hard to earn their living. I was inspired by their uproar in the Anarkli district. Loftier than the heavens is the station of man, and the beginning of education is respect for man.
Iqbal lays heavy emphasis on the familiar secrets and mysteries of rapture. Familiarity, as seen by Gnostics, means to entertain the self, to fully know the self. It's a famous statement that knowing the self is meant knowing God. Iqbal emphasized, first and foremost, returning to the self. Search within yourself in order to know the self.
Iqbal invites us to know ourselves before doing anything else. Anything else. We shall heighten ourselves to become a human being, all excellence.
From God's own being, the self got a being so. From God's own show, to self he gave a show. About this shining pearl, I know not where. It could be then without a river there.
Iqbal meant to look carefully at human beings on the one hand, and to look carefully at Islamic ideology on the other hand. For that very reason, we see Iqbal describing in detail the Eastern society and the essence of Islamic thought.
Who is a selected man? A selected man is the one who is searched for by God. He is in a form desired by God. God wants that kind of human being. This is possible only if man searches for his self, to train himself in a desirable way, to maintain the self, to try hard to fully understand the self. This way finally leads to knowing well the Supreme Being.
The greatest message of Iqbal, as expressed in his poems, is to know yourself, to turn to your own self, to know the East, not the West.
Thank you.
signs of going senile can be seen very easily in me. The tick-tock of the clock shows clearly the passage of my life. So quickly pass opportunities. So little time have I to reach the end of the line. Oh, the memory of those days when time's sword was allied with the strength of our hands and unveiled the face of truth. Our nails tore loose the knot of this world. Our bowing in prayer gave blessings to the earth. From the jar of truth we made rosy wine gush forth. We charged against the ancient taverns.
इस घर की तामीर हमारी दादी की ख्वाहिश पे की गई थी पर वो इस घर में
This house was built under my grandmother's wish. But only for two or three days she lived here. She was sick when they carried her in a car, but she survived only for two or three days. At the age of 11, my father lost his mother when my aunt was about 6 years old. My father and my aunt would come here every day to see Allama, who was lying on this bed. Allama called them and my aunt would come up to Allama and my father would sit on the other side of the bed. This way Allama would feel comfortable.
I usually went to see them after school. Allama was always lying on his bed and resting. I was always beside him. Other people would also go there.
Many came here to see him. Among them, General Muhammad Ali Jinnah, Jawaharlal Nehru, Muhammad Ali Jauhar, and many other intimate friends of Allama. They would come here just before or after midday to have a chat with Allama about topics like poetry, philosophy, or any other things. Allama spent his last days of life here.
I was well aware that the main reason why India went under the yoke of British colonization was lack of knowledge of self and reliance on others. Self-awareness springs out self-dependence and internal richness. Know yourself, know your hidden parts. Nurture your parts and create a new world, which will compensate for old shortcomings and soul defects, to pave the way for comprehensive development. It is the self which originates existence. It is self-awareness which gives birth to human values. It is the self which affects existence. What human beings see or intuit is a manifestation of the self. Through mysteries. The form of existence is an effect of the self. Whatsoever thou seest is a secret of the self.
Iqbal's philosophy is objective and tangible. He pulls down philosophy from the metaphysical world to make it tangible and applicable to common people. Iqbal's philosophy is therefore a practical philosophy. It can be put into practice.
O Muslims, you have to preserve your own self. You must follow God and His book, the Holy Quran. When you achieve success in making your own self, you can resist even the whole world. No one can harm you. What is the basis of survival? Survival is based on making your own self. It is the self, the nature mentioned by Quran. And this is the essence of Iqbal's thoughts. This is what Iqbal means of the concept of self. For that very reason, every member of the Islamic world should know this way of thinking, personally and socially.
Today we see a group of ignorant people who commit, under the name of Islam, the most heinous acts, though they are all against Islamic teachings. In fact, they are all Satan's companions and toys in the hands of those who want to mislead them. About these people, Iqbal says, Europe very well knows how to secure interests, while granting to this takes a loan of that. It gives sustenance to Satan in a way that leaves perplexed even God.
Nowadays, there are calculated plots against Islam. The enemy is very active to destroy the Islamic world from within. I personally think that we need Iqbal's ideas about Islam now more than ever before. You are simultaneously a learned man, a Sayyid, a descendant of the Prophet. But tell me, are you a Muslim too?
A Muslim is called infidel by another Muslim. It is not a non-Muslim who calls him infidel. It is a Muslim. All problems are created and spread here and there by those who are pursuing only their own interests.
The phrase which brings unity to you all is, there is no God but Allah. As Iqbal says, the key to our unity, salvation, and survival, and a sign of familiarity, is in this phrase, there is no God but Allah. Those who follow this phrase never behead Muslims. Iqbal's basic philosophy is that all of us should be unified. All of us should form one single family. Muslims should get unified to guard the sanctuary. I mean Muslims from the Nile shores to the city of Kashgar.
Iqbal tells us to put aside personal interests and to move into a direction leading to social interests. Put aside your personal interests. Let's talk about our religion, our unity. We will end in success. Just because of his thoughts, Iqbal is living on today. I think so.
Just have a look at the tragic events caused by a group of people who are Muslims in name only, as if there has never been a person like Iqbal. His philosophy has sunk into oblivion, as if Iqbal never lived among us. This is a great sorrow, casting a shadow over all Iqbal's philosophy and thoughts. There is no memory of him anymore. The light of all his great books has gone out. The everlasting letter, the familiar secrets, the secrets of rapture, the Persian Psalms, what can be done, O people of the East, the route of philosophy in Iran, the Eastern message, and reconstructing Islamic religious thoughts. During his last days, Allama says, as Iran, full of unknown meaning, I am unable to endure censurers' sayings. Neither have I any option, nor am I coerced. I am but a living soil, always in revolution.
इसी तरह जब आखिरी रात थी अलामा साहब की तो वो दोनों बच्चे इसी दरवाजे पे आए.
Then came the last night of Allama's life. His two children came to have their last look at him. Allama was still conscious. Someone from Germany had come to see him, a friend of his or his teacher. The German called the two children and hugged them. My father was leaving the room, but my aunt wasn't. She wanted to stay with him for a while. At the time, I felt I had to stay with Allama and to sit there motionlessly. Our tutor, Aunt Doris, came there to take me with her. I told her, I will stay here at least for a while. Allama told the tutor,
she knows that this is the last meeting between the father and the daughter. That is why she doesn't want to leave. Let her stay.
She knows this is the last time she sees her father.
And finally, I felt something was going to happen. For that very reason, I didn't want to leave the place.
रात
Early in the morning, Allama passed away. The muezzin was calling out the morning adhan. Here, beside this bed, was standing his close friend, Ali Bakhsh. There were some other friends too, although most of them were saying their morning prayers at the mosque at that time. Back then, the mosque was more like a house than anything else. Friends were there to say their prayers in congregation. After their prayers, Allama passed away. His last words were the two testimonies. Then his soul flew to the sky. I personally suppose people like Allama will come to this world several centuries later.
Allama Iqbal Lahori died at the age of 61 on April 21, 1938, after a life of diligence and hard work. In the last moments of his life, he put his hand on his chest, telling Ali Bakhsh, his man, "I have a pain here." And upon uttering this ambiguous, meaningful remark, he bade farewell to the world. Many attended his funeral and accompanied him to his final resting place next to Masjid-e-Shah in Lahore. On his deathbed, Allama composed this song. Does a song gone come back again? No, no, no. Does a breeze come from Hijaz? No, no, no. There finally came to an end all those days of poverty. Does a Gnostic come back a second time? No, no, no. Allama's thoughts and philosophy will remain with us forever, only if we follow him.
In the limelight. The House Select Committee investigating the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January is targeting about 20 individuals connected to the former U.S. President Donald Trump's command center at the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C. Among them, the legal scholar John Eastman, who outlined ways to deny Joe Biden the presidency. We now present you an article written by Hugo Lowell under the heading, "Lawyer John Eastman and Michael Flynn Among Six Subpoenaed by U.S. Capitol Attack Panel." The U.S. House Select Committee investigating the Capitol attack has issued subpoenas to six of Donald Trump's associates involved in the effort to overturn the results of the 2020 election from a command center at the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C. The subpoenas demanding documents and testimony open a new line of inquiry into the coordinated strategy by the White House and the Trump campaign to stop the certification of Joe Biden's election win and whether it was connected to the 6th of January insurrection. House of Representatives investigators on Monday, 8th of November, targeted six Trump officials connected to the Willard. The legal scholar John Eastman, Donald Trump's campaign manager Bill Stepien, Donald Trump's advisor Jason Miller, and the former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, Trump's campaign aide, Angela McCallum, and the former New York Police Department Commissioner, Bernard Kerik. The Select Committee Chairman, Benny Thompson, said in a statement that the panel was pursuing the Trump officials in order to uncover every detail about their efforts to overturn the election, including who they were talking to in the White House and in Congress. The six Trump officials compelled to cooperate with the Select Committee may have some of the most intimate knowledge of how the different elements of the former president's effort to stop the certification fit together. According to a source familiar with the matter, the subpoenas for John Eastman and other Trump associates, first reported by The Guardian, show the Select Committee's resolve to uncover the center of gravity from which Trump and his advisers schemed to overturn the election. U.S. House investigators are taking a special interest in John Eastman after it emerged that he outlined scenarios for overturning the election in a memo for a 4th of January White House meeting that included Donald Trump, the former Vice President Mike Pence, and Trump's Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows. According to a source close to Trump, at the meeting, John Eastman ran through the memo that detailed how Mike Pence might refuse to certify electoral slates for Joe Biden on 6th of January, and thereby unilaterally hand Donald Trump a second term in office. The source said the former president seized on John Eastman's memo, reviewed by The Guardian, and relentlessly pressured Mike Pence in the days that followed to use it to, in effect, commandeer the ceremonial electoral certification process. Donald Trump was not successful in co-opting Mike Pence, and Congress certified Joe Biden as president.